On the programme, a space for art in hospitals, reimagining public health policy. Hello and welcome to Arts Tonight. For many people, the experience of illness and hospitalisation can be a traumatic and rather sterile experience, even when the clinical outcome is positive. But internationally and increasingly here in Ireland, there's a movement to integrate aspects of the arts into medicine and into day-to-day hospital life in the belief that it can help the patient not just as a comfort or distraction, but also sometimes at a clinical level. On tonight's programme, we'll talk to a number of people engaged in arts and health projects, beginning with the Cloudlands project, where a number of artists are working with children in hospitals in Dublin, Cork and Galway.
We're here in Temple Street Hospital with Sarah Dyer and Rachel Tynan. You've been working together as part of the Cloudland project, I think on play and art and making something positive out of a time of being in hospital and illness. Rachel, tell me a little bit about, first of all, about how you got involved in the Cloudland project.
So there was an advertisement put out looking for artists who were interested in working in the Cloudlands project. So I went for it, and I have a background in doing some arts and health work and working with teenagers specifically. So that's why I was really excited. And so I met Sarah a couple of months ago when I'd been here for about 5 months already working. So I went down to one of the wards, and I work directly at the bedsides of the teenagers because a lot of them can't come up to the playroom. So I went down and I met Sarah at that stage, and she'd been in for a couple of days and was feeling better and definitely ready to do something. So we started having a chat and we're talking about different things, and we decided that we would do a bit of a shadow puppet film, didn't we, the first time? Yeah. So Sarah can tell you a bit about that. Yeah, she's good at this.
What did you do, Sarah? What was it like?
Well, we decided to do a shadow puppet. I don't really know why, but we decided to do a shadow puppet, and we did it with hands. So we did shadow puppets with hands, and that we made it into a video, but it was of a shark, and then we made my teddy into a shark. So it was from my hand to a teddy from a shark. So it was a teddy hand shark shadow video.
And I think that you do a little ballet as well, don't you? You're a dancer.
Yeah, I do ballet.
And did you manage to bring a bit of movement into this?
We used face paint, and we made my hand and my mum's hand into a dodo. So we painted the dodo's face, and then we had the wing, and they'd cross over, so they'd look like a dodo and its wing.
This is the old extinct dodo that we're bringing
it back to life. Yeah. But it was lovely because Sarah was lying in the bed and she was sort of missing her dance, and she'd been talking about it, and her mum was very proud, and I'd already seen the video of her dancing and she was fantastic. So we were able to do something that still involved her body and was still sort of performance art in a way, but that she was able to lie down and we were able to take photographs and film it. But I'd ask at the end of the day, I went back and I was saying, oh, have you washed your hand? Sarah hadn't washed her hand yet. And she'd also refused to let her mum wash her hands. So I don't know how long was it before your mum was allowed to wash her hand.
It was that night, but my hand had stayed yellow because I kept on for too long.
You have to dance so long.
Art should be made to last.
Absolutely,
It shouldn't be just a temporary thing. Yeah. Sarah, I'm sure you didn't expect anything like this in hospital. Did it make a difference to you?
Yeah, it made my day better because I wasn't thinking about feeling sick. I was thinking about having fun time doing art. So that made my day better during the week.
And Rachel, I'm sure that's part of the intention with this, is that, you know, that it will take the minds of young people off their illness and being in hospital, and not just as a distraction, but as something really positive, that they can make a positive experience out of what otherwise might be largely about their illness.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's, you know, it really disrupts that sort of everyday a routine that that teenagers have in the hospital, and especially if you're here long term, you know, you don't have as much ownership and many choices. So it's great that they can have a choice to be able to, and we always ask them whether they want to partake in the project, so it's absolutely okay if they say no, and we ask them what they want to do and how long. You know, it's very much up to them, and I don't know what I'm going to do on any one day. I walk in and we just go with it and see what the teenagers want to do. So each day is unique for the teenagers because it's up to them, and it's to give them choices and ownership over what they want to do. And also it does, it gives them sort of a sense of something beyond the everyday, you know, routine. And also if they can look a bit sort of beyond what sort of things they might be interested in and look at their bodies in a different way as well, if you're doing things like the body art, you know, rather than just the medicalization of the of their bodies. So yeah.
Sarah, what made you interested in the dodo?
I'm not really sure. She said, Rachel said to do something not very normal.
Something
you wouldn't see every day.
Exactly, yeah. So that's
and certainly the dodo
yeah.
is something you would not
We were
see
talking
every
about
day.
Animals that you'd like to turn your body into, and I was thinking, you know, what would be an animal that you wouldn't see every day? And Sarah came up with the dodo, and we were all laughing at that, thinking that's a great idea, that you could bring the dodo back to life in the hospital. Yeah. So it was a nice way to do it. And we also did little skeletons, didn't we? And we did a flick book. And often if we're doing films, I'll put them on DVDs and post them back to the teenagers. So
I think my dad took us. And I don't really know why. He took it and he did something with it.
I think he hid it because he thought it was a birthday card.
You are Sarah's dad.
That's right, yes. Yeah,
tell us what you did with this envelope.
Well, I knew Sarah was very pleased with the work that she'd done. So what I did was I kept it for her birthday so she'd have a bit of a birthday surprise. And it was very nice to see what had been done afterwards to the post-production. It was excellent.
As a parent, what did you make of this whole experience?
I thought it was an excellent idea because Sarah was full of tubes at the time and very, very sick, and her morale was quite low. So what you're looking for is you're looking for anything to try and make her a bit happier and a bit of cheer. And so when Rachel appeared with artwork and stuff, I knew Sarah would be enthusiastic about that. So we were delighted, actually.
And Sarah, is that what you remember most now from the time in hospital? You know, this making of the dodo and the shadow puppet and the film, all of that, rather than the tubes and the illness.
Yeah, that's what I try to remember. it's mostly what I remember because I don't remember feeling sick at all. So there was times where I did remember, but it was best when I remembered about doing the art, because it was better than being sick.
Yeah, I imagined it would be.
I'm Julie Collins. I'm one of the play specialists here in Temple Street. So our role here in the hospital is to provide a normal setting for the children when they're coming into an abnormal environment. So we try to do that through play. We'd work with children from the age of tiny babies right up to 17. So it's important for us to provide play for children of all sorts of ages, stages and abilities. At the moment we're in the sensory room. This is a room that's specifically built, that was sponsored by Vodafone, for children who have additional needs, or, you know, it appeals to all their senses. So we have fiber optic lights, we have a bubble tube, there's soft flooring and everything lifts up. There's a hoist for children who are in wheelchairs, they can be lifted out. We have an aquarium outside where we have tropical fish and a little garden that's attached to it. So they love coming down here. And with here and the playroom, no treatments are allowed to take place at all. So these are safe havens in the hospital, which is essential for the kids.
And I presume they love the fish out of the aquarium. The
yeah, there's Finding Nemo fish in Dory. So that's a real treat for them to come down and see real life fish that they've seen on programmes and stuff. Yeah, so.
And what kind of response do you see from the kids when they get away from the wards and the times of illness to this?
Yeah, I mean, it's great to see them to get out. Most of them are bedbound. Say they'd be stuck in bed all day until the playroom opens, and the minute I come onto the ward in the morning, you'll hear, when's the playroom open, can we go yet? And there's a queue of kids waiting to go up to the playroom because it opens at 9:30 and they're probably awake from about 8 for breakfast, so there's a queue of them to run up the stairs. So they go up to the playroom then until about 12:15, and then it opens again for the afternoon. So they spend, it would take up a good part of their day, say between like the 9:30 and 4:00, so it gives them time to be themselves, to be a child, they know they're safe there and no treatments can take place. So it gives them something fun to do. There's a pool table, an Xbox, a Wii, arts and crafts stuff, doll houses, a ball pool, there's a pool table, everything. So they have, I mean, they've loads of things to do. So they're not bored in hospital, and that's important, especially if they're long-term children here, you know.
And, you know, we were just talking a moment ago to Rachel Tynan and Sarah there, and it's terrific. I mean, the work they're doing seems, again, to be linked
to what you do.
Yeah.
But I suppose again, it's that area of play and making, and I suppose with older teenagers, where that can actually turn into real creativity and into the arts.
With teenagers, you find if a lot of the younger kids love arts and crafts, and you know, when you offer that sort of stuff, they're delighted. With the older kids, it's kind of that bit harder, because we don't have a great range of arts and crafts activities aimed towards teenagers. So when Rachel came in and she saw these great ideas, and you know, her training and background have provided her with that, which is brilliant. Like, one of the long-term patients here, she was developing a computer game with him because he's really into computers, and this was just, you know, he couldn't even believe that he could do this here. And another one of the children has cystic fibrosis, and her idea of her project with Rachel was to develop a body and to develop the lungs, and she wanted these tablets they have to take called Creon, and she wanted to show the body with the Creon tablets in it, and they did. It's just amazing if you've seen the whole project that they've done together. But everything that Rachel has done with each individual child has just been so different, and it offers them something that we haven't got. Like, she has great expertise and training in everything that she offers them, and we don't have that. So it's brilliant to offer the children here, especially teenagers, something new. You know, we never had that before.
Is the work ever tough emotionally?
Yeah, there is days that you would get a bad day, or you'd work with a child who's really, really ill. And sometimes it's hard to walk out the door and leave that behind you, as much as people tell you that that's what you need to do. You know, you get very close to children in here, especially if they are really sick and they're long term and you're visiting them every day. It is hard. But most days are brilliant. And if you can put a smile on one child's face just for that day, and the parents see the effect it has on that child, then your job's done for the day. You know, you can go home happy.
Julie Collins, play specialist at Temple Street Hospital in Dublin there. English artist and theatre director Mark Storer is mentor to the various Irish artists working on the Cloudlands projects. His shows include For the Best, based on his work with children on dialysis in a London hospital, and Hungry Tea, seen at last year's Cork Midsummer Festival. Mark Storer, it's a very interesting balance, looking, for instance, at the way you approach that show For the Best, which ran at the Unicorn Theatre in London in 2009.
Yes.
Children from a dialysis unit, 9 children, their stories, but then working as well with children from a number of schools, and then a team of professional artists and performers. Bringing all of that together is quite a balance. How do you achieve that, I suppose, that mix of participation and public performance and the sensitivities around that?
I suppose the thing is, I've been making work for 25 years, and over that period of time, you kind of begin to develop a methodology, but also people begin to trust the process. So, you know, part of making an application is saying, I don't know what the end result will be, because if I know that, then actually I'm manipulating people to fit into an idea that I already have. So in making the work, you have to keep a very open mind and try and stay sharp to the possibility of what could be. So one of the objectives of the Evelina Children's Hospital, which is part of Guy's and Thomas's, was that they were saying lots of stuff comes into the hospital, but very little material goes out in terms of what's happening there. So that was one of their objectives. So to think that we would be making some kind of public performance sort of 18 months ahead of that, already something was coming out. But part of the process is I made life-size self-portraits with everybody. And one of the boys created this phenomenal self-portrait, which where he describes himself as a tiger, because he said he had to be a tiger to fight the tiger of the disease that he had and what was happening to his body. And although he hadn't been to school for 3 years, he was still on the school register, and his school were fantastic. And suddenly there seemed to be an opportunity here that maybe we could turn his self-portrait into an adventure game, that aspects that members of his class would be given tasks to do, which by going through the tasks would begin for them to understand what it might be like to be a young person in hospital and to be him. And so we communicated with the school. They were really, really supportive and really enthusiastic. And that's what we did. And Ollie, for the first time, went into school for a while so that he could remember what it was like. And then we developed a series of tasks. And every day I would go, every week I would go in as the messenger to direct the children through these tasks. And if they failed them, they were bound with a ribbon. So by the end of 6 weeks, there was this phenomenal sight where the whole class was walking down the corridor bound in ribbons, ready to face their next task. But by the time it came to the performance, they absolutely understood what the work was about. They totally recognized that they were not playing the children in hospital, but they were their kind of gifted representatives in a way. They were like totems to remind us where the work had come from in the first place. I mean, I think it's very interesting that the Royal Liverpool Hospital now are exploring the possibility of having an artist in residence for a year working on the dialysis unit, because although we were absolutely working on making art, what they recognised was that on the days that I was in working with people, they tended to dialyse better for longer, which meant that their bodies were more were in better condition for if a transplant was to become available, if an organ was to become available, that they would be able possibly to go ahead with that, whereas sometimes people's bodies aren't in good enough condition for them to be able to have the operation. But also at the same time, people were making work. You know, I worked with a young woman at Liverpool, and we spent a lot of time embroidering a hospital bedsheet with poetry and text. And it's quite interesting, one of the knock-on effects of that, just purely apropos to nothing really, is that she did have a needle phobia, but after we'd spent so much time using them, she was I know this is strange, but she was able then to put needles into herself. So so it's a twofold thing. The art is leading in a different kind of way.
Yeah, so literally the transformative power of art, it would seem, at times.
Exactly, but we couldn't have gone in with the objective of how can we do something that will change this young woman's attitude to needles. That would have been pedestrian, but actually, and again, it's quite manipulative, but it's okay if we're saying to her, this is what we're going to try and do. But it was just a happy accident.
So sometimes you're going on a journey and you don't quite know where it will end.
Exactly. In fact, that's all the time. But the fact of not knowingness doesn't mean that that's a weakness, and it doesn't mean that we don't know what we're doing and that we're not taking care and monitoring ourselves and working with people and reflecting at every step. Because also, eventually, the form of the work has to be dictated by the content and the story, and that's why, you know, Rachel and Emma and Esther are also developing different ways of working depending upon the stories that are coming through.
Mark Storer there, mentor to the artists in residence in the Cloudlands project currently running in Temple Street Children's Hospital in Dublin and also in Cork and Galway University Hospitals. Joining me now is Helena Hugel, Artistic Director of Helium, the non-profit arts and health organisation which created Cloudlands. Also here is artist Dennis Roach, who recently created Pankaya, In Search of an Equal Utopia and a Willing Suspension of Disbelief, I love that title, at Visual in Carlow, with people using the mental health services in Carlow. Collaborating with him were artists Emma Finucane and Brian Maguire, and Brian Maguire also joins us from Paris. Helena, you set up Helium, I think, 5 years ago to give as many children in hospital as possible a positive experience, transformative experience of working with artists in residence while they are actually in hospital. Cloudlands, one of those projects. What motivated you to start this organisation?
I suppose it's all been kind of born out of my own practice as an artist. For about 10 years now, I worked as an artist in hospitals with children from age 0 right up to teenagers. I've worked all over the country as a puppeteer, mainly as artist in residence, or as a performer myself, so creating site-specific work. And I suppose the work grew beyond me and required further collaboration and to bring other artists on board and mentors and partners. And I think the need was just sort of much bigger than myself. It just made sense then to kind of form a company.
So I presume you saw what this work could achieve with children in hospital and wanted to broaden the scope of that.
Absolutely. And as one person, as one artist, a lot comes out of your relationship and working with the young people. But I suppose I just had a vision that this to bring this further to more.
And as you said, you know, your own background in puppetry and as a play specialist. And I have to confess, I hadn't been quite aware of the important work a play specialist does. But meeting Julie Collins in Temple Street, whom we heard there, it was quite clear just how vital that work is. But it strikes me that to provide this kind of service, you know, you need an enlightened attitude from the medical professionals and the hospitals themselves. Is that always present? I mean, are you always pushing out an open door, or are there obstacles there sometimes?
There's both. You know, you find one extreme and the other. As an artist, you need to be able to be flexible to deal in both those situations. And you're always working to bring the staff on board, and you're always sort of open to those who are willing to step into that kind of creative engagement with you, and then open also to try and, I suppose, create opportunities, little opportunities to bring even the smallest gesture from those maybe who don't feel it's as easy to take that step. So.
And is there a scepticism at times towards the importance of work like this, you know, art in hospital? I mean, are there people who say this is a place of healing? This is an arena for science primarily, and medicine and the arts shouldn't be in there.
You see, I think because we work with children and young people, and because all of us, whether we're artists, whether we're play specialists, whether we're medical staff. In an ideal world, we have the children at our best interest. So I think it is a little bit different when you're working with children as opposed to adults. There's a little bit more openness. And I suppose I'm a big optimist. So I do see some skepticism, but I do see a lot of staff who are willing to take part.
And do you see people changing as they encounter this what's done?
Yeah, I think that's the most reward. Apart from working with the children, one of the most rewarding aspects is seeing, for instance, a member of staff just taking a moment. It's time, you know. Because it's a medical word. Time is hugely of value, and it's measured constantly in hospital. And to just see a member of staff just take 5 minutes to walk into the room, to sit down, to actually some take part maybe in decorating a crown for a child, suggesting a colour for a costume, or taking a prop within one of a performance, you know, just to even take 5 minutes, it's huge.
So in a sense, the changes are as significant at times for the staff members as for the children.
Yeah. Definitely. It's I think our work is about transforming the environment, and the ecology of the hospital. And that's the people, that's the place, and it's the participants.
Yeah. How is the work of Helium funded, you know, with projects like Cloudlands?
Funding takes time, and it takes a lot of planning, and it involves not just one, but usually many funders. And we're delighted to say that this year we have funding from the BNP Paribas Smart Start Foundation to fund the project in Temple Street for 3 years, which then allows us, I suppose, leverage to raise further funding elsewhere. So we work with, I suppose, we have funding to support the project nationally. We have funding, and we look for funding locally as well. So each project is also funded by a local sponsor. So that would be the Medtronic Foundation in Galway, and also PepsiCo Foundation in Cork. Also, the local authority arts officers in all locations are very supportive. So we bring it together from small funders to larger funders.
Dennis Roach, your project Pankaya, involving people accessing the mental health services in Carlow, and again with the support of the arts officer there, the arts officer and Carlow County Council. Tell me about Pankaya. I mean, I was intrigued that this is actually a mythical island, and this is the idea partly, that I suppose the core of the project, the journey to the ideal place.
Well, absolutely. I suppose it arose out of, I was commissioned by Carlow Local Authority Arts to make some work that addressed sort of stigma and social exclusion and isolation that arose for people who were living with a mental illness in the county. And that kind of came out of some previous work that I was doing in hospitals, a project called the Open Window Project, where I was working with people who were in isolation and connecting them to the outside world using artists to mediate that connection. So it started off, they brought me down to make that work in the hospital in St. Dimphna's. But in actual fact, they were closing down St. Dimphna's at the time. So it became about engaging with the community and working with people who were, you know, outside of the hospital in that sense. But the idea of a kind of utopia or a wished for place became sort of the motif for the project. You know, I was looking at other projects, other groups that had worked with communities in this way, and a crowd called Wolkenklaus in Austria. Had done some good work where they kind of really worked at mobilising the community, really changing attitudes, and in that way kind of bringing people into focus in a way that kind of helped them to reduce levels of stigma and social isolation. So, I mean, the story of getting to the island was really...
You built a boat.
We built a boat. The only tangible part of the project really about it was, you know... I knew that we needed to make a journey, the community needed to make a journey, I as an artist did, the participants. So, you know, we thought, well, what would we need to get to our place that we wanted to get? So that really kind of formed the overarching motif for the project, where when I brought in Emma Finucane and Brian Maguire to work with me on the project. And Emma began by going down into, say, South County Carlow, working out of a day centre there, where she got to know people who were attending the clinic there on a weekly basis. And she just put it to them about places in the community that were, around the county that were of significance to them. She then travelled with them to those places on an individual basis and made photographic and video work of that place. And she learned the story of that place for them, why it was significant. And then she made some prints that she, you know, under their instruction, that she then presented back to them at the end of the project. So in a way, that was a kind of a mapping of the territory. And then the next stage, Brian went into St. Dimphna's in Carlow, into the mental hospital there, and took over an old ward and turned it into a painting studio.
And we'll talk to Brian about that in a moment. Sure. But your own work then, because you've said that in visual, in that great art centre in Carlow, you made a mess. And
yeah,
they were terrific and they allowed that and made it possible.
Yeah, well, I mean, these are, you know, it's working as an artist in this kind of way, what I would call socially engaged artwork. There's and working with groups where there's big issues around privacy, and the kind of public face of how art is made and conveyed and exhibited. So there's a tension that creates, and it's actually...
It would be a sensitive area, this is public and private, and putting work in an exhibition. It's very deeply private work.
Exactly. And particularly for people who their own choice and opinion and voice in the work needs to be very much respected at all points, and you need to be very careful because these things thunder along. At a certain point, they become, you know, they get their own steam, and you've got to be careful that you're not, that everybody's on board together, and you're sure of that.
And I think for you as well, it was very much about the community and the community response, not just the individuals taking part in this project, but how the entire community embraced all of this, and ultimately then the exhibition.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I suppose it began with the idea with Sinead Dowling and the Public Arts Working Group in Carlow, who said that they wanted to do something around this issue. And so they put up the money to fund it. And then it was up to us to figure out how to make sense of that. But the final stage of the project was we built the boat in the Visual Arts Centre, which, you know, brought its own. I needed the suspension of disbelief for that one a lot, but we brought in master boat builders. We set up in the studio gallery in Visual, and we started building a boat. And for 2 months, we built a small tender, boat, and everybody worked on it together. I worked on it, and the boat builders and the participants worked on it. And we made it as part of the exhibition. And on the opening night of the exhibition, we launched it in the pond outside Visual, which was a really powerful and special moment, I think, because the group of people that we were working with picked up the boat and brought it out from behind cover and walked it around and launched it onto the water. And there was a real moment where everyone was together watching that, and it was a very proud moment, I think, and a sense of achievement.
But it's a wonderfully symbolic image.
Well, I think so, because I think issues around responsibility and usefulness and all those kind of things that might pertain to this kind of project, are borne out when people are given the opportunity to work in this way and to actively join in a kind of a group imagining about things. And perceptions did change and attitudes did change.
Brian McGuire, as Dennis was saying there, you came in, worked in St. Dimpna's, transformed what had been an old smoking room into an art room with your collaborator Jimmy Leonard, who'd worked with you before. And the St. Dimpna of that hospital, I believe, has links to Belgium and to Giel, where you worked on another project not unlike this.
That's correct. I worked for Lieve van der Wel, who was in charge of the family care program in the Openbaar Psychiatric Zorg Centrum, which is the official name of St. Dimpna's in Giel. There are 600 patients in Giel, in the hospital, but there are only 150 beds. The other 450 patients are cared by upwards to 400 families in the area. One of the senior psychiatrists there, Dr. Loda Wins, coined the phrase in one discussion. He said, "Sometimes the patient cures the society." And in terms of the thinking behind what we did in Carlo, which was we were dealing with stigma, Giel and its family care program have advanced far beyond stigma. They've advanced to a situation in which the patient is seen as very much part of the community, a valued part, completely integrated into the community. The average length of stay with a family will be 20 to 25 years. So if you can perceive that, how that works for so many people, it has changed that whole area to such an extent that when a family have like a Down syndrome child, the question of moving to Giel becomes on the table, because they can move to a place where the whole society is geared to handling their child.
So, I mean, that's a very practical example of something. Yeah. Deeply transformed. And again, the story is that the same St. Dimpna travelled to Belgium and in a sense fostered all of this from the beginning. But your own work then...
800 years ago, they say. They talk about 800 years and they have completely different meaning than we have.
It's a great way of looking at time. Your own work then in Carlo. Tell me about that. I think, how did it work? I think that the people working with you came in once a week over a period of 6 months.
6 months, yeah. I was assisted by Eddie Cahill in the work. We set up a studio. We provided an environment, which an earlier speaker spoke about. You simply provide a safe environment and some leadership, but not a lot. So that they can paint their own story. And what came out of the event was that the pubs got painted, the gambling machines, the football matches, the sewing circles. An interesting aspect was that the wished for life that got painted was sailing. Loads of people made paintings of boats sailing, and they had never sailed. In terms of the end of the project, that's interesting to me. They painted their ex-partners, their divorces, their flowers, their work, their homes. In other words, they painted ordinary life as any dozen or so people wood.
And did you see, I mean, I know that a number of people who took part in the project and worked with you went on to apply for third level art courses as a result. I mean, that's a very practical example of change and transformation. I mean, did you see, and you've worked, and we've talked about this on the programme before, you know, you've worked in hospital, you've worked in prisons, and you've talked about, again, you know, how important that sort of work is in the prison service. Did you see other examples of change in people's, even small transformations resulting from this 6 month period?
Well, the biggest thing that I saw was at the end when their work was shown in visual. I mean, visual is a cathedral in Carlow town to the visual arts, and their work was hanging there, and that was extremely important to them, to their kind of their acceptance within the community. The way they carried that boat out, and the way I remember the nurse leaving the crowd to go up to help carry it. She had worked on the job, you know, and looking at the people carrying the boat, you would have no idea who was who or what was what, what role they had. When they became equal. The city manager came to a seminar in visual, which dealt with this project, and he sat there for the duration of it. That in itself was quite extraordinary. That this, you know, the representative of local government, the chief, spent an afternoon looking at this work. It all spoke to me about the integration of their existence into the cultural life of the community.
Dennis, you oversaw this entire project, and I suppose people will talk about the difficulty of proving that art has any transformative quality in the area of medicine.
You know, sure.
And another project you were involved in, Open Window, was evaluated and held to have specific benefits. Tell me briefly about that project.
Sure. Well, I mean, the Open Window project was a project that started in St. James's Hospital in 2001 and developed into a clinical research project. So I developed a sort of concept around a virtual window that was mediated by artists. So we had artists making work for patients that were in isolation while they were being treated for leukemia. And there was a whole clinical team, Professor Sean McCann, Dr. Catherine McCabe, who constructed a piece of research around this intervention. It became known as the Open Window Project. It was a full randomised controlled trial, 200 patients over a 5-year period, funded by the Irish Cancer Society. It's published in the Journal of Psycho-Oncology, and we showed that there was clinically significant impact to what was happening in the rooms. Things like levels of anxiety and depression, and people's quality of life. You know, it was a mixed methods study, so there was some hard psychometric tools being applied, and also kind of qualitative results, you know, kind of interviews and all the rest of it. But the results would show that in a clinically significant manner that this intervention had an impact.
Elena, very briefly, how important is this area of, again, clinical evaluation for yourselves in Helium? I mean, is there a bit of an onus on you to show that this has, you know, a real effect in order to, for instance, to secure funding?
It depends on the funder, but we, you know, and I think we have to kind of maintain a balance that, yes, it's important, but, you know, the art itself has its own integrity as well, and you don't want to end up kind of medicalizing the importance, the value of the art either. So yes, it's important, and yes, we're looking. We have potentially a research partners, and we will be heading down that line.
But I suppose that the projects have to happen. The art has to be there before any evaluation can come. And I suppose that's again,
it's a chicken and the egg.
Chicken and egg, and completely. What's important and the prioritizing of that.
Yeah.
Thank you to all of you. You're listening to Arts Tonight. We're looking at arts and health and the importance of arts programmes in hospitals and in medical education. Back after the break.
RTE Radio 1. This is Brian Dobson with a special message for National Bike Week 2013. Events are taking place throughout Ireland from the 15th to the 23rd of June. Free bike checks, fun cycles, lunchtime city rides, road races and much more. There's something for every age and ability. Log on to bikeweek.ie to see what events are taking place near you.
At Childline, we're committed to always being here for children. But you were about to hear a call that ended with the child who made it, feeling lonelier and more abandoned, desperate and bereft than ever before. Childline is 25 years old. The worst calls we ever get are the one in every three we haven't the money to answer. Please help. Donate now at ispcc.ie.
Could say there are 90 reasons to call 11890 for directory inquiries, but you only need one. 11890 is cheaper. 11890, cheaper directory inquiries. 11890. See 11890.ie.
On your Deutschmarks for ein, drei, zwei. Because Opel's 132 Summer Fest is now on. To celebrate July's new registration plate, we're making 132 Opels available for 132 hours. With free 5-year warranty, free 5-year service plan, plus a free 5,000-kilometer fuel voucher. Orders must be placed by the 22nd of June. Terms and conditions apply. Opel. Wir leben Autos.
If you've got a lump sum, a one-hour consultation on how to make the most of it could cost you, well, a lump of money. But not with AIB. That's because AIB offers free advice on your lump sum, tailored specifically to you. And you'll get a personalized report with no obligations. So call into your local AIB branch today to arrange for your lump of free advice. Allied Irish Banks PLC is a tied agent of Irish Life Assurance PLC for life and pensions business. Allied Irish Banks PLC is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.
Welcome back to Arts Tonight and this programme on arts and health. Mary Grehan is director of WHAT, the Waterford Healing Arts Trust, and joins us now from Waterford. Mary, tell me about the trust and the work you do. What is WHAT's philosophy, as it were?
Well, WHAT is about bringing the arts into Waterford Regional Hospital and into the wider community for the benefit of patients, staff, visitors, and of course for artists as well. We began very much embedded in Waterford Regional Hospital, beginning at the bedside of patients in the early 90s with my predecessor, Afric Gray, who was then artist in residence. And a programme has grown and we now have a broad-based multidisciplinary arts programme that works across a range of healthcare settings, from acute hospitals to mental care settings and community settings, incorporating live music, exhibitions, public art commissions, poetry, and so on. But we also have a national remit in that we are very much a support organisation to help develop arts and health nationally, and we manage artsandhealth.ie, the national website for arts and health.
And that website, I think you run in conjunction with CREATE, that organisation that does a great deal in this whole area of, I suppose, of the arts and public policy. I'm intrigued, you know, you are a visual artist, but from a family of nurses. So did your own involvement in health have to get out there somewhere eventually?
It's kind of funny. You wake up one day in your mid-40s and you ask yourself, how did I end up where I am? And you look around and I am from a family of nurses. My mother was a nurse. She trained in Birmingham in 1945. My aunts were nurses, my sister and sister-in-law and so on. And yet I went into art college and I majored in ceramics. Early on, I became an arts manager and I worked in arts management since on and off since 89. And yet now I'm back working. When I say back working, I'm working in an acute hospital setting. And I think there's part of me, frankly, that's a frustrated nurse. You know, I find hospitals a fascinating place to work. And I think they are fascinating for artists because they're really where, you know, birth, death and everything in between happens, and sometimes with a heightened intensity. And of course artists and writers, and I'm now a writer as well, are interested in the human condition. And this is where it happens, where people are vulnerable, and where the arts plays a real role in building individual people's resilience in coping with challenging and stressful circumstances.
On precisely that point, you know, what effect do you see this having on patients in hospital? You know, bringing poetry, bringing music, bringing visual art, bringing painting into hospital, does it help people who are sometimes suffering? Who, you know, hospitals can be a pretty stressful place at the best of times. I mean, does it help in some way almost to soften that experience?
Yes, I mean, when you go into hospital, you put on your pajamas and you wait for medical. You wait for the results of tests and you hope for the best, or all kinds of things happen. But there's a lot of anxiety connected to the experience. And what the arts bring is an opportunity to regain some control. You know, if you are involved in art making with one of our artists, there's a lot of creative decision making where you have a say in what it is you want to make and how and so on. And for example, every Tuesday I work with a 90-year-old woman in renal dialysis, and for the last 8 weeks we've been working on a painting. She's absolutely inspirational. She's 90, but she's open to learning and growing. And when we're working together, it's about the art. And meanwhile, the machine is in the background cleaning her blood. And for a lot of people on dialysis in particular, that waiting and that sheer waste of time and how they square that up with their lives and their feeling of being useful and productive is really challenging. And so the arts are an experience that can be scaled up and scaled down to depending on your circumstances, and can happen at the bedside. And our working together is really revealing for me as well. When I see her absolutely engrossed in what she's doing, and she says to me, she says, "You don't know what a difference this makes, this hour." It's not about killing time, just about killing time. It's about building that resilience and her regaining a sense of her own identity within the institution.
Do you think there's enough official recognition and support for this kind of work? I mean, I know the Arts Council has an arts and health advisor for the past number of years, and they've a public policy document on arts and health and have funded many projects, including your own and Dennis Rota's project that we heard about earlier. But what about the medical profession and hospital management? In your own experience, and I know you'd worked at Hollow Street National Maternity Hospital as well for during their centenary celebrations. In your experience, is there an enlightened approach on the part of hospital management to this whole area?
Yes and no. I would say that in Waterford we've enjoyed real practical support from management over the years, and that is evident in lots of different health settings across the country, but it's still happening at a grassroots level. So it's individual healthcare professionals who champion this work in partnership with artists and arts managers and make it happen. But in terms of it and across the board, there is no official HSC policy. And you might say, well, what difference does that make? I mean, what would that do? And I do think that if there was a HSC policy supporting this work, and I'm not even talking about investing money, I'm talking about the principled support of it, that healthcare professionals on the ground would then be empowered to go forward and integrate and seek to integrate arts into the settings in which they work through partnership, for example, with local authorities and local arts organisations.
You've also just published your own first novel,
yes.
Love is the Easy Bit, with Penguin. And it's interesting how the projects we've talked about so far tend to bypass the spoken or written word in favour of visual communication. But you've moved in the other direction, from visual art to writing. And I think now you're hosting writing sessions with nursing students at Waterford Regional Hospital. I wonder, how do you think that experience may illuminate their work in nursing?
Yes, it's very interesting. One of the things I do with nursing students is I get them to write about an encounter from a point of view of the patient. And for that, they have to imagine all the things that patient might be bringing to the encounter, all the unsaid anxieties, which, of course, as writers, we consider when we're writing in the point of view of a character. So I do think that the writing can and imagination can build empathy, which is something that of course healthcare professionals need to not let go of when faced with the day-to-day challenges of their work. So I do think writing is a really powerful tool for building empathy, for reflecting, for understanding, and to find words for the things that we may have subliminally known up until now. That is invaluable to healthcare professionals.
Mary Graham, thanks very much indeed. And an interesting article on that website, artsandhealth.ie, is A Marriage of Apparent Opposites, The Arts in Medical Education, by Dublin GP Dr. Austin O'Carroll. In it, he examines ways in which the arts could contribute to the development of a more ethical, empathic and compassionate connection with patients. Austin O'Carroll, in your own training as a doctor, was there room at all for the arts, or was it all science, maths and the body without particular space for the spirit or imagination?
I didn't necessarily get an exposure to the arts, but I would put as one of my inspirations two particular doctors in my early career. One is Professor James McCormack, who in first and second year in medicine taught to us about the whole idea that medicine was not surely about the body, but that in fact that the emotional aspects of medicine, as well as the social aspects. And he was also a wonderful speaker and a wonderful writer. I always remember one of my favourite articles about him was The Value of Sloth, which he wrote in a medical magazine. So even though he didn't do the arts, he wrote like a good writer would. And I would say a number of people have put him as an inspiration. And he was the first doctor I ever heard talked about how he loved a patient. And so I would say, you know, a lot of where my thinking about medicine came from him, because he would challenge the whole ethos of them, the predominance of the biomedical model.
In your own work then, as a GP, have you tried to integrate any aspects of the arts into your medical practice?
Well, very interesting. I have a practice which is inner city Dublin. And in that practice, when I first arrived, for example, I once heard loud knocks next door and I thought it was outside, and I thought there was someone doing building. And I left her for a few minutes. Eventually, I got annoyed and I went outside to try and stop these builders, to discover two people trying to take out my fireplace in the waiting room. So there was a lot of theft in my particular building. It was that type of area. There was a lot of drug use. And at one stage, I got the practice done up and I put a lot of art into it, a large amount of art. And everyone says, don't put the art in. They says, you know, it'll get stolen. It won't last a few days in the wall. What's interesting is no art has ever been stolen, but also everything else stopped getting stolen. And I think it's not purely the art. It's the fact that you do your place up to show you respect your clients. And the clients come in and they have their own interpretations of what the art is, because I tend to find I don't just go for nice paintings, I go for stuff that sort of challenges medicine. And so I find it really interesting, and we have great conversations about the art pieces in my room.
So you'd have people react, for instance, to abstract sculpture and have a conversation about it that happens almost in conjunction with their coming to see you as a doctor.
Absolutely. I mean, I have these pictures on the wall, which are beautiful. Everybody comes in, they're pictures of birds and animals, and then they realise that they're all dead. It's roadkill, and it's beautiful photographs of roadkill, and they're like, oh, God. And then I have another picture, a beautiful picture of a woman who's dead and another woman who's breastfeeding, and that intrigues them. So we have these great conversations about it. And for me, they're all sort of art related to medicine. So I find them interesting. And they open up different ways of discussing, talking to people. Yeah.
We featured the NUI Galway Medical Orchestra on this programme in the past. It was a good example of medical students exploring their own creative expression within the context of their training. Presumably, initiatives like that are something you would feel strongly about, that they can help enhance the medical profession later and make for better doctors.
But I use the arts a lot. I also run a GP training programme specifically to train GPs to work in areas of deprivation and with marginalised groups. And I would use the arts in that particular area a lot. And I think there's the concept in the arts, in medicine we talk about as the science of medicine, but very much becoming predominant now is the concept that we need to be reflective practitioners. And that is that science tends to sort of see us as if we're all working in a laboratory and we're all white rats, And reality is, we're all out in practice, it's mucky. People don't come in with classic stories fitting the classic prototype of what is a medical diagnosis. And it also includes that there's problems at home. And so each time, each individual scenario does include elements that are scientific, but we need to be reflective to be able to try and react in the moment, because it's 10 minutes of a consultation, to this undeveloping drama. And so we need to be able to develop reflective processes that ingrain our ability to respond in the immediate over time. That experience is not experience that is a bad, you know, that as an experience can get you into patterns of behavior that are bad, but by being reflective we're trying to develop proper patterns that allow us to respond appropriately. And I use the arts in terms of to develop that concept of reflectivity. So for example, I work in, as I said, I'm trying to train them to work in areas of deprivation. So Theatre of the Oppressed is a wonderful way of teaching them about oppression. And what's really interesting is that we end up doing Theatre of the Oppressed, not about oppression against patients, but about oppression in the hospital system against doctors. And then they can relate that to oppression for patients, because it's their own experience. They recognise that that relates to patients' experience. But then I've also, for example, I don't know if you remember that wonderful play, The Boys from Foley Street. And
yes, we featured it again on the programme, a remarkable piece of theatre.
Remarkable. And we've been trying to teach them social medicine, and we brought them down to The Boys of Foley Street, and it just brought us straight into the whole feelings of being, the feelings of how drug users developed and what they had to face as people. And nothing, you know, those hour and a half was much better than 20 hours of teaching with the blackboard, so...
What about measuring outcomes in this whole area, you know, arts and health? I suppose scientists, and you pointed out in your article, scientists are always keen to measure and to prove. But could it be that the impact of the arts in medicine and medical education is almost immeasurable?
No, I think it's a difficult one, because in one way you have to engage with the science, the evidence-based movement, because people will say you need evidence. And I think that's a fair call. If, you know, if you're going to invest money, and it depends on the amount of money, if you're going to invest large amounts of money into a therapy, you need to have evidence that it makes a difference. Okay, so if you want to show the arts make a difference in terms of health, all doctors will ask for evidence, and that's a fair call. I do think there was, I recently reviewed it, and there wasn't huge evidence supportive of the arts, but in that, when I looked at that review, it was mainly that there wasn't good research done, or there wasn't a volume of research done. So there is an aspect that the research hasn't been done. Another, I've always felt the presence of the arts in medicine improves the experience for the patient immeasurably, I believe. And I think that in itself is a positive argument for improving the arts. Going down the route of showing that it improves health, I'm not saying don't, but just be wary.
Austin McCarroll, thanks very much. And thanks indeed to all our guests on tonight's programme. Sarah Binchy produced this programme. John Davis was on sound. From all of us, good night.